This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley. When Planet Earth was shown by the Discovery Channel in March and April, it was the most popular show on cable, and with good reason. Planet Earth was the most outstanding TV program of the season. And now that it's out on DVD, it's even better, for reasons I'll get to in a minute. My next guest is one of the producers of Planet Earth, Hugh Cordy, who was directly responsible for three of the installments. With the BBC Wildlife Unit, he also was a producer on Life of Mammals, one of many superb nature programs hosted by Sir David Attenborough. In England, Attenborough was the narrator of Planet Earth as well. But for American audiences, the Discovery Channel replaced him with actress Sigourney Weaver. It's an ill-advised substitution. In terms of TV nature documentaries, David Attenborough is the best guy on the planet, and his work is much more emotive. But there's good news. The DVD box set of Planet Earth, which is fabulous, includes the original Attenborough narration. It also features him as narrator of the making of the film DVD extras, like this one, about one of Hugh Cordy's Planet Earth programs on caves. Most of the powerful moments in Planet Earth come from the stunning images, but in this clip, as the crew descends into a cave populated by thousands of cockroaches, the sound is plenty.
Of all the habitats the Planet Earth teams had to deal with, undoubtedly the one that was to provide the most unpleasant working conditions was the underground world of caves.
Look at that. Thousands of cockroaches. There's a few juveniles in the molting phase here, and just everywhere you look is cockroaches. Look at that. Beautiful sight.
Oh, that's just creepy. Now, tell me, first of all, how did the cameras handle that, and how did you handle that?
The cameras handled it remarkably well, which was actually quite a surprise, given the high humidity and the amount of filth that was in this cave. I mean, there was guano everywhere, so the dirt was getting into everything, but it handled it well. How we handled it was, I would say, slightly different and varied from one member of the crew to another. I found it absolutely fascinating, I have to say, but there were two types of cockroaches you got in this cave. One was the sort of big cockroaches, flying blasters, as we like to call them, that you might find in...
Is that a technical...
Yeah, that's what we call... Yeah, yeah. It's a very technical term that we use in the natural history world. And they're the sort of cockroaches you might find in a rather downbeat pizza restaurant or kebab shop. And there were literally thousands of those. But there was another type of cockroach, a very sort of almost a pretty cockroach, if that's not a contradiction in terms, a sort of a golden cockroach, is much smaller, that lived on the guano mound itself. And there were literally hundreds of thousands of these things. And they looked fairly benign. But actually what happened was when you did wade amongst them in the guano, they could get into your clothing and they did give you a little bit of a bite. If they got trapped between your clothes and your skin. So what we did was we wore these paper suits that you might wear when you're in a sort of chemical lab situation. They didn't last very long, these suits. They were made of paper, so most members of the crew would sort of tape up the crotch in particular with gaffer tape.
Oh.
Because that was what went first, and obviously that's really not a place you'd want to have cockroaches crawling into.
Oh, so, and it's, you know, probably their favorite place to go.
It's nice and warm and cozy, yeah. And so, there were moments where I think most of us felt, we probably couldn't stand it for much longer. But, you know, the crew were there for probably about 2 or 3 weeks on one shoot and maybe 3 weeks on another shoot. So it's something you just had to get used to, grin and bear it, if you like. But just to sort of go back a bit, when we started the series, the producers had an opportunity to pitch for certain programs. Mm-hmm. And I was convinced that everybody would want to do caves because there was so much new there. We knew nothing about them. I knew nothing about them. I thought, wow, here's an opportunity to show something new without even trying. And so behind the scenes, I was sort of almost quite forceful with Alistair, telling him that I really, really was keen to do caves if I was going to work on the series. And he said, okay, fine, you know, you've made your preference, but, you know, we'll talk about it around the table with all the other producers. And then we had to write down in order from 1 to 11 what programs we actually wanted to do. So as I just mentioned, I put caves first. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that I was the only person who put caves first, and everybody had them 11th out of 11.
You've described what we can't see on the radio about being down in those caves. Can you describe what we couldn't smell on the television?
Well, with the cave that we've just talked about, the one with all the cockroaches and guano, there was a very, very strong smell of ammonia. And when we were filming on the guano mound, this huge, almost like 100-meter mound of guano, the smell of ammonia at the bottom was quite strong, but not that bad because there was enough air movement. But as you climbed to this guano mound and got closer to the roof, there was a point where it was literally like hitting a wall. You could not go a meter further. Your eyes started to sting. The smell of this ammonia got into your lungs and burned your lungs. It was an incredible experience. It really was like a wall. But other than that, caves don't smell too bad, you might be interested to know.
Hugh, two of the other programs that you were specifically responsible for, besides caves, were desert and jungles. And I've got specific questions about both of those. With the desert, it's one thing to plan in advance and say, hey, let's go film some wild camels. And it's another one to actually get it done. Can you talk about the difference between those two ideas?
Quite. Although with the camels, there was a certain amount of similarity between those two ideas, because when I heard about the camels in Mongolia, in the Gobi Desert, I definitely wanted to film them. There was something, to me, right from the word go, that were very, very unique and fitted in very well to the story. But I knew from the start that they were incredibly difficult, because practically the first person I talked to about it had spent some time trying to study these animals, and he made it very clear right from the word go that here was an animal that was quite capable of spotting you from 4 kilometers and running in the opposite direction for 70. So I knew it was going to be difficult. But you know, that was the great thing about Planet Earth, is that we were given the opportunity to fail. And I know that might sound odd, but that was why we in the end probably filmed the things that we did, because we had the time and we had the resources to try things that people hadn't tried before.
Does it get to be a point of honor among the various crews, you know, say, oh, it took me 60 hours to get that shot? Well, 60 hours, that's nothing, that sort of thing?
Yes, definitely. It was like that Monty Python sketch where they're talking about what it was like when they were younger. Do you know that one?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. I think one of my shoots probably trumped most people's, in that we put in 600 hours in hides, or at least one particular cameraman did. 600 hours in hides for probably about...
Explain what a hide is.
A hide is what you'd call a blind. So it could be made of man-made materials like a little tent, or it could be made out of forest vegetation. So it's a place where you can conceal yourself.
Okay, go ahead.
And these, obviously, you want to keep them small. So very often a cameraman is sitting in something that's probably about a meter square. So this cameraman sat in various hides or blinds in New Guinea trying to film birds of paradise courting. Now, we knew it was going to be tricky. I mean, that wasn't something we went into thinking, wow, this is going to be a piece of cake. But we did think it was going to be a hell of a lot easier than it was. As it turned out, that in the 600 hours that the cameraman put in, we only filmed about 25 minutes of actual behavior. For huge portions of the shoot, nothing happened at all. And it was very frustrating that this was an animal which you could see fairly easily, because they have these, the male birds of paradise have these dancing grounds or leks. So you pretty much know where you need to be, but they're not going to do anything until a female shows up. I mean, it was extraordinary. And in fact, when the cameraman came out, I was there in the first month, and then we went back the following year for another month to try to do better than we'd done before, but also to shoot an additional species. And when he came out on the last day of that second month, he said that tears just welled up in his eyes, and he nearly broke down in tears in front of his local guide, because he just couldn't believe that he'd put in all those hours and hadn't got what he had hoped. But actually what he had got was a brand new species of bird of paradise filmed for the first time in its courtship. That was the blue bird of paradise.
Mm-hmm.
And he filmed the superb bird of paradise, which probably everyone remembers, because it is the most extraordinary display. A lot of people refer to it as the smiley-faced bird because it looks like it's got a big iridescent smiley face on the front of it. It sort of folds its wings into a disc and jumps up and down. And even though he only filmed 25 minutes worth of footage, you know, they were extremely memorable shots.
Oh, it's one of the most memorable shots in the entire 11 hours, and there are plenty of memorable shots in those hours. In these behind-the-scenes programs that are part of the DVD, there's a lot of explanation of how the images were captured, but not a lot about how the sound was. How meticulously is that done?
It's very meticulous, but the sound is one of those things with natural history films that sometimes confuses and disappoints people. Disappointing in the sense that people, I think, always expect it to be recorded at the same time. So when they hear that it's not, they sort of think, oh, okay. But actually, when you explain it, people go, oh, okay, I understand. I mean, as you can imagine, when you're actually filming something, it's very difficult to have a sound man sitting next to you trying to record the sound. Mm-hmm. You'd hear the sound of the cameraman, the camera going around, and so on. So in most cases, the sound is recorded separately, but it's all totally authentic sound, but just not recorded at the same time.
I don't believe that this was your episode, the thing that I'm just about to ask you about. But it's the one where that poor little baby elephant gets lost and goes the wrong way following the tracks of her mother. And the last image that you see of this sequence is this shot from helicopter of just miles and miles and miles of nothing, with this poor elephant, heading probably towards its death. Do you know the sequence that I'm talking about?
Yes, very well. It's a very tragic shot.
And I wondered, cynical TV critic that I am, I was like, couldn't somebody have landed the helicopter and just turned the elephant around when you were through getting that great shot? Or is there some Hippocratic oath for environmental filmmakers that you never help?
Well, you know, a lot of people have asked us that, and we had quite a lot of letters and emails along the same lines. But
I'm glad I'm not alone.
No, definitely you're not alone. Because people, it doesn't make any sense to people. They think, look, you were there, you saw it, couldn't you do anything about it? But you're absolutely right in what you said afterwards. Yes, there is an unspoken law amongst natural history filmmakers that you don't involve yourself in the struggles of nature. We are there to document it, not to try to interfere with it. I mean, there are some times where it wouldn't make sense not to interfere. There's a nice moment in the making of the Antarctic section where the partner of the cameraman pulls an emperor penguin chick out of a hole that it had fallen into. Well, you know, it wouldn't have mattered. It didn't matter to the species that she just put her hands in and picked the chick mm-hmm. out and gave it back to its mother. It would have been rather hard to have done otherwise. But with that elephant, who's to say that it would have worked? Landing a helicopter next to a wild animal like that, it may have been dangerous to the elephant, to the people inside the helicopter.
Right, I hadn't would given it that much thought as terms of the rescue plan.
That's what we've had to answer, because people say, why didn't you do it? Well, you know, an elephant's a very big animal, and you know, turning it around when it may feel like it absolutely wants to go that way may have just stressed it out even more.
This may not apply so much to the hours on which you worked, the programs on, you know, caves, desert, and jungles. But it seems to me that over the course of the 11 hours of Planet Earth, a decision was made very early at the very beginning to sort of downplay the grizzly. And I'm saying grisly, not a bear. is that true?
No. It's not true. I think that we in the UK may not place as much emphasis on those big predation stories that the US might have done in the past, although I think they're slightly changing. But we certainly didn't hold back if it was relevant to the story. And I think in every program there were moments which were poignant and perhaps controversial in their content I can give you a few examples. The lions taking down elephants. I mean, we had a lot of letters about that. The chimpanzee infanticide. The fur seals taking the king penguins. I mean, there were certainly moments that were that some people would have found tough to take.
Well, I guess what I'm asking, because, for example, that night footage of the elephants being taken down, yes, it's very dramatic and it's filmed beautifully, but I'm just thinking that once there is an attack, once there is a death, that there's not a lot of rending of the flesh or a lot of blood afterward. Although certainly, I mean, I'll never forget the great white shark coming out of the ocean parallel with a, was it a seal in its mouth or
That's right, sea lion? Fossil. Yeah, sea lion.
You know, I mean, so I'm not saying that it's not there, but I'm just wondering if it wasn't dwelled upon in terms of the after effects. And I don't know if that was a decision or not.
Well, I think that we were fairly subtle when it came to death and destruction. We were quite subtle in the editing, because at the end of the day, once you've made a point like this, yes, that wolf that chased the caribou calf gets it, you don't necessarily need to see its throat being pulled out. I mean, I watched the raw footage of the fur seals taking the king penguins, and I've been in this business, you know, 15-20 years. And I find that quite tough to take, because what the seal did after a bit of a standoff was grab the penguin round its neck and shake it. And in many cases, it actually flayed the animal alive. And to see a penguin trying to get back in the sea without any skin over its head is not the sort of thing you'd want to show an audience. And another example, and in the footage of the lions taking the elephant, there's a scene where the elephant, the lion has the elephant's trunk in its mouth trying to suffocate it. And there's another shot of the elephant's eye very much alive and awake while there's 20 lions eating it alive, because obviously lions can't kill an elephant in the normal way. They can't bite its throat. It's too big. And that eye shot was in one of the earlier cuts of the sequence. And I remember thinking, I personally, I really wouldn't put that shot in. And there were other people the same felt the same way, and Alistair asked for it to be removed in the end. Because at the end of the day, natural history does have a family audience. And I don't think the aim is to try to shock people. But it's not to sanitize either. And we definitely didn't take the standpoint of, okay, let's try to sanitize it as much as possible so anybody can watch it. Where there were tough sequences, we definitely didn't shy away from it. But to be gratuitous with the sort of blood and guts, I think would have been wrong for the genre.
What's the one shot in the entire program, whether you photographed it or not, of which you're proudest?
It was something that I'd tried on a previous series and failed. So I was incredibly proud that we'd got it. And it was the shot of the fungus, which was rather appropriately named Cordyceps fungus. My name's Cordy, so I always thought it was rather appropriate to be likened to a parasitic fungus. But this fungus gets inside invertebrates. In this case, it was an ant. And then the fruiting body of the fungus bursts out of the head of the ant. And it's just, we filmed it in time lapse, and it was just the most extraordinary shot. And actually, if there's one thing that I thought was rather appropriate about having Sigourney Weaver do the narration, is that it looks like something from Alien. So, you know, who better than Sigourney Weaver to explain it?
That's funny.
But it, we didn't know, nobody had ever filmed this before. This is the first time ever somebody had filmed this group of parasitic fungus in time lapse of this fruiting body emerging from an invertebrate. We were in Ecuador, and the consultant found, I mean, he literally had to find a distressed ant.
Yeah.
Can you believe that? In a rainforest, finding an ant that looking a bit iffy. Found the ant, and then we set up a time-lapse camera, and we had no idea how long it would take. We thought it was going to take, I don't know, 3 or 4 days. The fungus's fruiting bodies come up fairly quickly in funguses generally. It actually took 3.5 weeks, and it was the last camera to be packed up when we were leaving.
Oh my!
And you know, it's such a weird and otherworldly shot, and it was something that I'd wanted to do for so long that I was very proud that we actually got that. And in actual fact, a week after it went out, a scientist in Scandinavia who'd been working with this this fungus species in other parts of the world, actually emailed me and said, you know, he'd seen it on YouTube. So somebody had taken it and put it on YouTube, which I thought was rather nice.
All right. Well, listen, Hugh, thank you very much again. I really do think it was a magnificent piece of work, and I can't wait for your next one.
Well, thank you very much. I'm really pleased to hear you enjoyed it.
Hugh Cordy, one of the producers of the series Planet Earth.